If you'd like to open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 6 as we talk about the man Noah. And his story is primarily found in Genesis chapter 6 through chapter 9. And so that's where we'll be spending the most of our time together this morning. Now, of course, when we think about Noah, the part of the story that gets the most attention is the story of the flood, right? Noah built the ark. And they survived the flood on the ark, and then after the flood, God made the new covenant with them, and that's the story of the rainbow. But let's not take it for granted that we all know that. Let's just give a brief overview of that story. So if you're with me here in Genesis chapter 6, we'll be looking at a few verses together as we kind of go through and unpack this story of Noah and his life. Of course, in the days of Noah, the world was growing increasingly wicked. We read in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5, "Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. And the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from the man to animals, to creeping things, and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I've made them." I mean, that's a pretty sad commentary on the condition of the world. If God looks down upon the world and it's so corrupt, it's so wicked, it's so evil that he just says, I'm sorry that I even made this. He's feeling that sorrow in his heart so much. He's grieved so greatly over the wickedness of his creation that he says, I'm going to wipe it all out and start over. I mean, that was pretty severe for God to have to get to that point. But of course, from the midst of this wicked generation, God saw one man at least who found favor in his eyes. That man was Noah. And so God calls Noah out from the midst of this wicked generation, and God makes a covenant with Noah. And God tells Noah in verse 13, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. For behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth." God says, I'm going to wipe it all out. And here's what you need to do so that you aren't destroyed along with everybody else. He says in verse 14, "Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood." And he gives a very specific instructions on how this ark is to be constructed. He says, you make it with rooms, you cover it inside and outside with pitch. This is how you'll make it. Verse 15, "The length of the ark is 300 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top, and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You'll make it with lower, second, and third decks." Right? So just to put it in perspective how big this structure is that Noah is building. I got a football field up here, and the dimensions of a football field is 160 feet wide by 120 yards long if you count the end zones. Okay, so that's 360 feet long. And there's a little bit of discrepancy as to how big exactly the ark was, because of course it's not given here dimensions of feet and inches, right? It's given in cubits. It was to be 300 cubits long, it's 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. And so, depending on what measurement you use for the cubit, there was what was called the common cubit, or the short cubit, which equates to 17 and a half inches for us, the way we measure things. And so if you were to throw those dimensions onto the ark, what was it? Or 300 cubits long, 50 cubits high, and 30 cubits wide, that equates to 44 feet high, 73 feet wide, and 438 feet long. So it's not as wide as a football field, but it's longer than a football field. Now, it could have been bigger than that, because there's also what they call the long cubit, which equals 22 inches. So we'll do our math again and calculate that. It could be up to 55 feet high, 92 feet wide, and 550 feet long. So we're talking about a total volume of approximately 1.4 to 2.8 million cubic feet in volume that the ark occupied. If you just count the surface area, the floor space area, you're talking about between the three stories, depending again on the size cubit you go with, 95,000 to 152,000 square feet of floor space. So that's roughly the equivalent of 2 to 3 football fields worth of floor space that the ark took up. Now, that's a pretty big structure that God commanded Noah to make. Pretty significant boat if Noah was the only one who was going to be saved. But the reality is God had bigger plans than just saving only Noah. In fact, we continue on in verse 18. God tells him, I'm going to establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. So it wasn't just Noah. It was also his family, right? His wife and their three boys and their three daughter-in-laws. They're all going to go into the ark. Eight persons total. Well, that's still a pretty significant boat for eight people, right? But God has bigger plans. He says in verse 19, and of every living thing of all flesh, you'll bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. As for you, take for yourself some of all the food which is edible and gather it to yourself. It shall be for food for you and for them. And so Noah was going to gather together all of these animals, right? Two of every kind. It's male and it's female. So a pair, so that that species, those animals, would be able to then survive the flood and reproduce and have babies and ultimately repopulate the earth after the flood. And he's also supposed to gather up food, seed, I would imagine, that could be eaten and then also that could be planted after the flood subsides from the earth. And it's interesting that Noah was faithful in carrying out all of these commands that God gave him. And so we see as we get into chapter 7 that Noah and his family and all of the animals go into the ark and God shuts the door of the ark behind them. It says in verse 6 that Noah was 600 years old when the flood of water came upon the earth. In fact, if you keep skimming down in the text to verse 11, we read that in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on the same day, all the fountains of the great deep burst open and the floodgates of the sky were open. And so that's when the flood began, was on the 17th day of the second month of Noah's 600th year. Of course, as you're reading the text, you realize they've already been on the ark and shut in it for 7 days before the flood water comes. If you jump back in verse 10, it came about after the seventh day that the water of the flood came upon the earth. And so it begins raining then. The floodgates are open. The fountains of the great deep burst forth. And the rain, verse 12, fell upon the earth for 40 days and for 40 nights. And so we have this torrential downpour. It's raining for 40 days and 40 nights continually. And as it's raining, the water is rising and rising and rising. And we continue reading in the text and we find out that the flood, verse 17, came upon the earth for 40 days and the water increased and it lifted up the ark so that it rose above the earth. And the water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth and the ark floated on the surface of the water. And the water prevailed more and more upon the earth so that all the high mountains everywhere were covered. And the water prevailed 15 cubits higher and the mountains were covered. And so as people, I could imagine, were scrambling to get to the highest mountain peak, they realized that even that was going to be covered by water. And there was no place left for man or beast to go to survive except on the ark, which was carried on the water through the flood. And Noah and his family were on the ark for quite a time. In fact, from the time that it began to rain until the time that the water began to recede was a period of 150 days. We read in verse 24, the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days, but God remembered Noah, chapter 8 and verse 1, and all the beasts and all the cattle that were with him on the ark, and God caused a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided, and also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained, and the water receded steadily from the earth, and at the end of 150 days, the water decreased. We read in verse 4, it was in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, that the ark came to rest on the top of Mount Ararat. Okay? But it's going to be quite some time before Noah and his family are actually able to disembark from the ark, because even though the ark has come to rest on the mountains, there's still lots of water covering the earth, and the water continues to recede. If my calculations are correct, it's a period of about 3 to 5.5 months before the water has receded enough and the land has dried out enough that it's now safe for Noah and his family to leave the ark. And we have the story in chapter 8 of Noah letting out the raven and it doesn't come back. And so then he lets out the dove and the dove comes back and he waits a while more and he lets the dove out again. And this time it comes back with the olive branch in its beak. And then he lets it out again and it doesn't come back, giving the sign that the earth is indeed drying up and it's getting ready to be time to leave the ark. But it's interesting that it's not until God gives the command to Moses in verse 15, beginning, God spoke to Moses, chapter 8 and verse 15. He says, go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you, and bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that's with you, birds, animals, creeping things that creep on the earth, that they may breed abundantly on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives. And again, if you looked at verse 13, which I skipped over accidentally, notice it says it came about in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first of the month, the water was dried up from the earth. And so Noah removed the covering from the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. But it was in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, that the earth was finally dry. So remember, they entered the ark on the 10th day of the second month of the 600th year, and they're not going to leave the ark until the 27th day of the second month of the 602nd year. When you realize how long they spent on the ark, they were on the ark, shut on the ark, the eight people with all those animals, for 1 year and 17 days, cramped inside that ark. Now, I granted, it was a pretty big ark, but with all those animals, all that food, that would have been quite an ordeal to go through. So it's interesting to me that when Noah and his family finally disembark, the first thing that Noah does in chapter 8 and verse 20 is he builds an altar to the Lord and offers up sacrifices to him of every clean animal. And indeed, the Lord smells the soothing aroma of that, verse 21, and begins to make promises to Noah and to his descendants. And he renews this covenant. And in chapter 9, we have a record of the rainbow covenant that God gives to Noah and to his descendants and to all flesh and to all animals. God promised, I'll never again destroy the earth with a flood of water. And that's why even to this day when it rains and we see that rainbow in the clouds, that is a visible reminder to our God that when he looks at that and sees that, he sees the same thing we do and he reminds him, I'm not going to flood the earth ever again. Not going to destroy it the way I did with the flood in the days of Noah. So that, in a nutshell, is the main part of the story with Noah that we typically talk about, that typically gets retold and points made from that. But I would like for us to focus this morning a little bit more on Noah the man rather than just the events of the flood and the covenant that God made with him. First of all, it's interesting to me when we think about the meaning of his name. You know, oftentimes Bible names have significance in their meaning, right? And oftentimes when the patriarchs, when the fathers would name their children, they would give them a name intentionally because of some characteristic or attribute of that child. Sometimes, as we read in the Old Testament, I believe that those fathers named their children prophetically. That is, God gave them some information about something that was going to happen down the line with that child. And so that's why they got the name that they got from their father. That seems to be what's happening with Noah. If you jump back to chapter 5 and in verse 29, we read about Noah's father, Lamech. In verse 28 says, Lamech lived 182 years and he became the father of a son. Now he called his name Noah. And notice why Lamech names his son Noah. He said, this one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. Now that was a fitting name if this was what Lamech's hope was, that God would give them rest from the result of the curse of the ground. Because the name Noah, Noach in Hebrew, literally means rest or reprieve. And so it's interesting to me that Lamech was hoping that it would be in the time of his son that God would give man a reprieve or a rest from their hard labor, which was a direct result of God cursing the ground. You remember when God cursed the ground, if you go back to Genesis chapter 3, when God is doling out the punishments to the serpent and the woman and the man when they ate the forbidden fruit in the garden. And we read in verse 17, the Lord said to Adam, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you. And in toil you'll eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it'll grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread until you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. God did something there, and he cursed the actual ground so that it was going to be with intense labor now that Adam was going to have to work with the ground in order to get the ground to bear forth its fruit, to give food to Adam and his family. It wasn't going to be as convenient as just tending a garden anymore where Adam could go and just pluck the fruit off of the tree. He's going to have to really work at it now, and that seems to be the intent here of this curse. And now after generation after generation after generation of by the sweat of your brow eating bread because the ground has been cursed, it seems like in the days of Lamech is tired of this labor. And he's hoping that Noah, his son, it will be in his days that God will give them a rest or a reprieve from this toil. Now, it's interesting to me that even though the deliverance that Lamech was hoping for and wishing for, rest from the curse of the ground, it may not have been as complete as Lamech was desiring, but it is worthwhile to observe what God promised Noah when Noah and his family came off the ark in Genesis chapter 8 and verse 21. Noah's just offered up the sacrifice, and the Lord smelled the soothing aroma, and he said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man. For the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. I think it's interesting that in chapter 3, God curses the ground in verse 17. In chapter 5, Lamech says, hopefully it will be in Noah's days that we will get rest from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed. And then after the flood, God says, I'm never going to again curse the ground because of man's sin. Now, I don't know if this means or is intended to imply that the curse was lifted during the flood. That is, that the curse was totally undone. Or perhaps it was just that it wasn't as bad after the flood as what it was before the flood. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I think there is something to that. And at the very least, it would be worth some serious contemplation. Was the curse undone during the flood? Was Noah's, the prophetic nature of his name, did it actually come true? But we'll have to talk about that at another time. You can chew on that for a while. Let's talk about Noah's character. And I want to start by saying that Noah was not a perfect guy. Okay? Now, this becomes evident when we read what happens after the story. If you go with me to Genesis chapter 9 and verse 20, we read, then Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. And he drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. And then Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon their shoulders and walked backward and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were turned away so that they did not see their father's nakedness. And when Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. So he said, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants. He shall be to his brothers. He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. And may God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant. Now, it's interesting, those blessings and cursings of Noah here are clearly prophetic, as it would be the descendants of Shem, from whom Abraham and ultimately the Israelites would come, and ultimately Jesus. And everybody's going to be a servant of Jesus one way or another. But certainly the Canaanites, who were the ones that possessed the land of promise before the Israelites came in, they were the ones who were going to come in and be conquered by the descendants of Shem. But we don't talk about this story very often. And I think it's for a couple of reasons. One, the first reason we don't talk about this episode in the life of Noah is because it is difficult to determine exactly what is happening here in this text. What exactly was it that Ham, the youngest son of Noah, the father of Canaan, did to his father on this occasion? It has something to do with uncovering or seeing his nakedness. And I'll be honest with you, there's a whole host of possibilities that it could be, ranging from what I'll suggest all the way up to somehow Noah's son sexually violated his father. But let me suggest to you that we don't have to go to that extreme in order for something bad to be happening here. In fact, I think what's interesting to me is the way that nakedness is used in the first 10 chapters of the book of Genesis. You remember when Adam and Eve were created in the garden, right? When God made them and brought them together and united them in that first marriage, the text tells us in Genesis chapter 2 that the man and his wife were both naked, but they were unashamed of their nakedness. It's only after they eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and have this realization that they're no longer innocent because they violated God's rule that we read in Genesis chapter 3 and in verse 7. Then the eyes of both of them were open and they knew that they were naked. And so they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. They attempt to cover up their nakedness. Because for some reason now, all of a sudden, though before they were unashamed, now they are ashamed of their nakedness. So much so that they realize their little loin coverings are not sufficient. So when they heard the sound of the Lord walking in the garden in the cool of the day, the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord among the trees of the garden. And the Lord, verse 9, called to the man and said, "Where are you?" And he said, "Well, I heard the sound of you in the garden and I was afraid." Why? "Because I was naked. And so I hid myself." And God's question is, "Well, who told you that you were naked? Why all of a sudden are you having this guilt, this shame over your nakedness?" And all throughout, the idea of shame or guilt of violating God's will, God's command, is coupled with this idea of nakedness and your nakedness being exposed and seen. And it's interesting to me, even though it doesn't state it explicitly, we read in verse 21 of chapter 3 that the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and he clothed them. God covered their nakedness. God covered their shame. And even though it's not explicitly stated, the implication is that an animal gave up its life to provide the skin to cover their nakedness, to cover the guilt of their sin. And so I would suggest to you that this idea of nakedness, at least the way it seems to be used at the beginning of the book of Genesis, is almost synonymous with the guilt of your sin. And so it certainly was a shameful thing for Noah to do, to get drunk and to just uncover himself. Though I find it interesting, he does it in the privacy of his own tent. It wasn't like he was just streaking through the neighborhood. It's in the privacy of his own home. And yet, it seems that because it was his drunkenness that induced him to reveal himself, even though it was in his own home, that's not really where the main problem comes in, at least as far as Ham. It's the fact that Ham intrudes into his father's private quarters and sees his shame, his nakedness. He sees his father laying there in a drunken stupor. And I would suggest to you that that in and of itself was not the bad part. The bad part is that it seems that Ham got excited about the fact that his dad had messed up. He seems to relish in the failure of his father, which is why the text says that as soon as he saw it, he went and told his brothers who are outside, "Guys, come on, you got to look at this. You got to see what dad's doing. What a fool. He got drunk and he's naked in there." Of course, the two older brothers were not willing to go in and make a mockery of their father. They wanted to leave him with some sort of dignity, and so they put his robe on their shoulders, walked backwards, and covered up the shame, the nakedness of their father. I think that's what's happening here in this text. But the other reason why we don't often look at this text, not only is because arguably that is a difficult interpretation of what's going on there. It's hard to figure out exactly. But the fact of the matter is that this is not an episode in the life of Noah that God seems to dwell on and remember. If you keep your finger here in Genesis, but go over with me to Hebrews chapter 11. In Hebrews chapter 11, we have the account of all of the great characters of faith, the men and women of old. And we have Noah mentioned here in verse 7. It says, "By faith Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith." Full stop. That's all that God has to say about Noah's actions here when he's remembering these great men of faith in his word. And I think that illustrates something. That when God looks at us, when God looks at his people, he sees not our failings, but our faith in him. And not that those failings didn't happen. Not that those sins were not committed. Not that they weren't bad and terrible and ugly and gross. But God has forgiven us of those sins. He's washed us clean. And so as he promises, "Your sins I will remember no more." So it's interesting when God goes back and talks about these men of faith, he doesn't say, "And remember that mistake that Noah made. Remember his sin." He just simply points to his faith and said it was by his faith that he gained approval. He chooses not to remember the sins, but rather to count our faith as righteousness. So I think for one of those reasons, we don't oftentimes find it important to go back and look at the failures all the time of these men of faith. And that's not what God does to us, though we can still learn lessons from them. Because there is that interesting statement in Genesis chapter 6 and in verse 8 that Noah found favor in the eyes of God. And notice that this statement comes prior to what the Hebrew writer says Noah did to gain approval of God. Because when Noah finds favor in the eyes of God here, he has not yet built the ark. He's not yet entered the ark. He's not yet saved his family from the flood. This is before that. And so I want to ask us a question. What was it that set Noah apart from this wicked generation? What was it about Noah that found favor in the eyes of God? Well, I think the answer is found at least partly in verse 9 of chapter 6. There it says, "These are the records of the generation of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God." And so the text tells us there that he was a righteous man. Not that he was a perfect man, but he was a righteous man. Well, what exactly does that mean? Well, the text says that he was blameless in his generation. I would suggest you again, not perfect, but he was blameless. And certainly when you would compare Noah to the character and the actions of the wicked generation that he grew up in, we might say, well, yeah, by comparison, I mean, he's white as snow, right? He's as pure as a lily, right? He has no faults in comparison to how bad they are. And it does seem that in that statement, he is being compared somewhat to the generation. In his time, in his generation, he was blameless by comparison. But here's the real key, I think. It's that last statement, that he walked with God. And the only other person that it says that they walked with God is found in Genesis chapter 5 and in verse 22, where it says that Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah. And by the way, Enoch would be Noah's great-grandfather. Enoch walked with God. So all the days of Enoch, verse 23, were 365 years. Verse 24, Enoch walked with God and he was not, for God took him. There was something different about Enoch than all of the other patriarchs mentioned in that genealogy. All of them, they get old and they die. But Enoch walked with God, and God seems to reward him for that by not allowing Enoch to suffer or experience physical death. Instead, he just translates him into heaven, into his presence. He was not, for God took him, right? And the reason God took him was because Enoch was the kind of guy who walked with God. Well, what exactly does that mean? I find it interesting that some similar terminology is used in Genesis chapter 17 when God is giving some instruction to Abraham about how he expects Abraham to conduct his life. Notice God says, when Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him. And this is not the first episode in the life of Abram. Already at this point, Abram has shown that every time God tells him to do something or go somewhere, Abram picks up his stuff and goes. He follows God obediently. Wherever God tells him to walk, that's where Abram walks. And that seems to be the idea of walking before God or walking with God, is that we yield ourselves to God's will. Whatever the Lord commands, that's what we'll do. We may not understand. We may not see how it's going to work out. But God said to do it, so we will do it. That's what it means to walk with God. And Noah was a man who walked with God. Yes, Noah was not a man of perfection, but as we read there in Hebrews chapter 11, he was a man of faith. He was a man of obedient faith. It said there in Hebrews chapter 11 in verse 7 that it was by faith that Noah built the ark, securing salvation for himself and for his family. We think, well, what does that mean? Why was it an act of faith for Noah to build the ark? How was that a demonstration? Well, the text tells us, being warned by God about things not yet seen. As best I can tell, there had been rain on the earth prior to the flood. It seemed that there was a mist that came up clearly in the garden that watered the plants and things like that. But as best I can tell, there was no rain on the earth prior to the flood, let alone some sort of regional flood, let alone some sort of cataclysmic earth-covering deluge. And I can imagine Noah as he's building this ark out here, this boat in the middle of this dry, arid field. People are walking up to him, hey, Noah, what are you up to, bud? Building an ark, man. An ark, what's an ark? That's a boat, it's a really big boat. Why are you building a boat here, bud? How are you going to get this thing to the water? Don't worry about that. The water's going to come to me. Oh, the water's coming to you. How's that going to happen? Well, you see, God is going to cause it to rain on the earth so much that the whole earth's going to... Okay, have a good day. As they walk away, thinking, this guy is loony. He spent way too much time out here in the sun. You see, it would have been a crazy thing for Noah to have done. It wouldn't have made sense to build this giant boat in the middle of nowhere because God said the earth's going to be flooded. That never happened before. Nobody'd ever seen it. But for Noah, because he was the kind of person who walked with God, that is, when God said to do something, Noah said, okay, God, I'll do it. I don't understand why. I don't know how that's going to happen. I've never seen anything like that before. But you said it's going to happen. I trust you. I will do what you said. Noah was a man of faith. What's interesting to me here in Hebrews chapter 11, this is the part that we don't like. We want to be people of faith. We want to put our faith in God. We want to be saved as Noah was. Because he did this thing, he became an heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. But there's a part that we don't like. It's the idea that by doing this, by demonstrating his faith, by in reverence preparing the ark and securing salvation for his household, inheriting righteousness, he condemned the world. That's the part that we don't like very much. You know, it's interesting to me, if you go back to Genesis chapter 5 and look at that genealogy that's listed there, from Adam all the way down to Noah. If you start adding up all of the years and tabulating all of that stuff, notice we get here, we got Enoch, his life was relatively short compared to everybody else because God took him up, right? He walked with God. And as I said, that was Noah's great-grandfather. His grandfather was Methuselah. Why is Methuselah famous? Oldest person on earth. That's right. Nobody lived longer than Methuselah. At least that's recorded for us. We'll put it that way. He was the grandfather of Noah, the father of Lamech, who was Noah's father. What's interesting to me is you add up all of these years. Remember, we talked about what year was it in the life of Noah that the flood came on the earth? This is the 600th year of Noah's life. That coincides with the 969th year of Methuselah, Noah's grandfather. And I don't think that's a coincidence. That if you add up the genealogies, Noah's grandfather dies the same year that the flood comes upon the earth. I would suggest to you that Methuselah didn't die of a ripe old age. He died of drowning. He died in the flood. Even if he didn't die in the flood, notice that clearly Lamech and Methuselah were alive during all the days leading up to the flood. In fact, Lamech, Noah's father, only dies 5 years before the flood. So almost the entire time that Noah is building the ark, almost all of the time that Noah is getting ready to save his family and all of the animals and proclaiming righteousness, as we read in 2 Peter, that he was a preacher of righteousness. During all of that time, Dad and Grandpa are standing back watching Noah go through this labor, go through this effort. And yet they aren't saved from the flood. Noah alone found favor in the eyes of God. The implication is that Methuselah and Lamech did not, which would mean they were part of that wicked, rebellious generation. The point that I'm trying to make is this, is that Noah could only save himself and those who would follow his lead. In this instance, the ones who followed his lead was his wife and his kids. But note clearly that his wife and his kids were saved not on the merit of Noah's faith, but on the fact that they followed his faithful lead. If you go with me in the book of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel chapter 14, God is talking to his people, the Israelites, and he's trying to impress upon them, like, listen, don't think that just because there might be some good people still in Israel, that that's going to spare the entire nation. And he goes on and he talks about this idea beginning in verse 13. He says to him, "Son of man, if a country sins against me by committing unfaithfulness, and I stretch out my hand against it to destroy its supply of bread, send famine against it and cut off from it both man and beast, even though these three men," and now notice who he mentions, Noah and Daniel and Job. I think it's pretty cool that Noah's mentioned alongside Daniel and Job here, by the way. We know a lot more about those two guys than Noah. But he says, even if those three guys were in their midst, by their righteousness, they could only deliver themselves. If I were to cause wild beasts to pass through the land and they depopulated it and it became desolate so that no one would pass through it because of the beast, though these three men were in their midst, as I live, declares the Lord, they could not deliver either son or daughters. They alone would be delivered, but the country would be desolate. And just so you don't miss the point, he says it again. Or if I should bring a sword on that country and say, let the sword pass through the country and cut off man and beast from it, even though these three men were in its midst, as I live, declares the Lord, they could not deliver either sons or daughters, but they alone would be delivered. And again, or if I should send a plague against the country and pour out my wrath and blood and cut off man and beast from it, even though Noah and Daniel and Job were in its midst, as I live, declares the Lord, they could not deliver their son or their daughter. They would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. So Noah's wife wasn't saved because of Noah's righteousness. Noah's boys were not saved because of Noah's faith. Noah's daughter-in-laws were not saved from the flood because of Noah's faith. They were saved because they, like their father, believed what God said. And God said, the ark is the only way that you will survive this. And so they got on the ark. But everybody else didn't. And that's the part that I think had to have been heartbreaking for Noah. Noah couldn't save his dad. Noah couldn't save his grandfather. He couldn't save his uncles. He couldn't save his aunts. He couldn't save his cousins. He couldn't save his siblings. He couldn't save his nieces. He couldn't save his nephews. He couldn't save his friends. He couldn't save his neighbors. All Noah could do was build the ark as God instructed him to do. And I think conservative estimates suggest that it took Noah at least 40 to 60 years to complete that big of a project, especially if only his three boys are helping him. Day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, getting up and going out and building the ark, putting his faith in God, knowing that his actions were by default condemning the rest of his loved ones, the rest of his family, the rest of his friends and neighbors who chose to reject God's salvation. Do you think that that weighed on Noah? Do you think that that pained his heart? To know that all these people that I love, unless they change and start listening, unless they would accept this free offer of salvation that God is giving to them here in this ark, unless they would listen, they're going to be lost. They're going to be destroyed. Do you think that that did not pain Noah? And to know that every day as he got up and he put his faith in God and let his light shine, that his light was exposing their darkness, that his actions were condemning them. Do you think that that made him sad? Well, unless Noah just didn't have a heart, I don't know how it could. But the point that I'm trying to make is this. Even though Noah knew that everybody else was going to be lost, he still put his faith in God. And he still built the ark. And he got on it. Just as the Lord had commanded him. And you know, there's a correlation between Noah and his life and the flood and the ark and us and our salvation. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 20, Peter says, who once were disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The only way to be saved is in Jesus Christ. He is our ark. And the only way to get into Christ is through baptism. And yet, how many people, how many of us are our hearts breaking inside of us because we have loved ones, we have friends, we have family who care not for God? Don't want anything to do with him. Have rejected him. And we want desperately for them to be saved. I think you can relate to what Noah was going through. He said, get on the ark. Get into Christ. We might beg, we might plead. What's worse is sometimes we actually balk at the idea of obeying God ourselves because we think, if I do that, I will be condemning my family. I'll be condemning my husband. I'll be condemning my parents. I'll be condemning my grandparents, my uncle, my aunt, my cousins,
my friends, my neighbor.
And sometimes some of us choose not to put our faith in God because we don't want to condemn other people. Recognize that if you make that choice, which you can, you're going to be condemned along with them. Noah had enough faith to get on the ark, even though the vast majority of his family did not. The question I have for us today, and for you to think about, is do you have enough faith to get into Christ, even if no one else in your family does? Will you be saved, or will you be lost along with the rest of those who reject the free gift of salvation from God? I hope you make a choice like Noah.